My name is Wendy Lonergan. I come from Western Australia, and so I didn't know what local people would know in the 1960s and 70s, that there was an old hospital on the site of Flinders Medical Centre.
Hi, Wendy. Thanks for coming into Service Voices today and talking to us about this old hospital, which, from my notes, is called the Bedford Park Sanatorium. Wendy, you mentioned coming from West Australia. What year did you come over from WA?
At end of 1983, and I moved to Bedford Park to live at the end of 1989. So about local things, I knew absolutely nothing. However, I went to work at Flinders Medical Centre and later at Flinders Private Hospital, and I gradually began to realise that some of the grounds indicated that there had been something there before. You know, there were slopes where there shouldn't be slopes, there were rows of trees where, and I got curious. Eventually, I realised that, yes, there was an old hospital, and I discovered an advertiser photograph from 1963 showing a small cluster of buildings, an aerial photo, surrounded by the new development of Bedford Park, which had only been started as a suburb in the early 1960s. That was all I knew, and my curiosity was aroused because even if I got a magnifying glass, I could not see what that photo was doing and what the buildings were all about. I didn't even know which way it faced. My own age group did know a little bit, as I discovered when I started to ask questions, but now I'm finding with the younger ones, many don't know at all about this old military hospital called Bedford Park TB Sanitarium or Consumption Hospital.
Have you always been interested in history?
Oh, absolutely. My father had an interest in Western Australia. He used to take me to places like New Norcia, where he was educated, and York, and tell me about his youth and playing cricket out in the back paddocks. And I developed an interest from him, I think.
Now, this sanatorium, you mentioned TB.
Tuberculosis was always a major problem in South Australia. I'm talking here mainly pulmonary TB. TB can also come as spinal or of the larynx and so on. But young men were coming home from the First World War, from the trenches in France particularly, and the numbers of people with pulmonary TB caused by the tubercle bacillus was rising exponentially, and nobody knew what to do with them.
Was it a death sentence for those sufferers?
Not completely, but it was only a generation since the tubercle bacillus had been discovered, and folklore virtually was saying, yes, it's the white plague, it's a death sentence. It wasn't always, because the treatment of the day was fresh air, good food, rest, and of course isolation because of its infectious nature. And with time, the bacillus could be enclosed or encapsulated, and there were quite a few who did recover from this early days treatment before we had streptomycin and the other treatments that came later. I was surprised when I first learnt that there were a few people who actually did survive. The sanatorium stay was a long stay, but it was the treatment of the day.
So you talked about young men coming back from World War One suffering from TB, pulmonary tuberculosis. At what stage was the sanitarium built and who built it? Who was the prime mover in getting it built? Was it the government of the day?
It was the military. In England, there were the Chelsea pensioners. The military were expected to look after their disabled and ill soldiers, sailors and nurses, although I can almost discount the help that was given to nurses because they weren't permitted at most of the places where treatment was offered. The impetus came from the military. First of all, the civilians, if they were close to the end of their time with TB and were dying, might end up at the Cancer and Consumptive Hospital in the parklands off North Terrace. Or they might go up to Kalyra with Dr. Galt if they had a little bit more money to die or to spend time in a sanitarium. But the military had to look after, let's say it's 1914, the war has just begun, and Dr. H.H.E. Russell, Lieutenant Colonel Russell, was appointed in charge of the 4th Military District, and that incorporated Keswick Barracks, which had only recently been built, but they did have a hospital. However, I don't think it was suitable for anything but fit young men. There were steep stairs, there were no toilets, much like when I started my nursing training actually at Fremantle Hospital in Western Australia, where the wards were very similar in the early 1960s, all that much time later. But This hospital fronted onto Anzac Highway. It was going to be able to take about 160, I think, but they'd had a cerebrospinal outbreak a year or two before, no, just after that, and they really couldn't take them. If you get the chance to go on the Sunday open day at Keswick, you will see how tents and huts mushroomed all over the parade ground to try and accommodate. In addition to that, they needed to commandeer buildings. They got an offer from the Bar Smiths. Well, that's now Scotch College. That became a military hospital. There were about 12 of them around Adelaide. However, Dr. Russell, the one I mentioned, Colonel Russell, he had a sister whose name was Ella Hancock. She was married to the second son of the mine captain at Moonta Mines. A lot of people know that there was a beautiful old stone mansion called Bedford Park. There was no suburb yet, but there was a Bedford Park and it was a 500-acre farm. And people know that it was the Hancock property. What they don't know is that it was actually in the name of Ella, his wife, and she was a Russell. And Lieutenant Colonel Russell was her brother. Now, he knew about this property and he said, oh, that wouldn't be bad. It's a farm. It's got a big stone mansion. It's all set up with the animals and the crops and it's isolated. It's out in the countryside. Don't forget this is what we now know as Bedford Park, but of course at that time it was rows of vineyards and orchards and glasshouses for growing cucumbers and tomatoes. The problem was it was 2 miles from Keswick Station and it was awfully close to the Flagstaff Hotel. This was a very prophetic consideration as it happened because a lot of our boys when they came home from the war didn't have the routine and the structure that they'd had in the army, and alcohol was a very good substitute for that, and they didn't have a niche to fit into. And this is not only the ones with TB but any of the young lads, so alcohol was a problem, but especially with the long drawn out sanitarium stay, and so they were very cautious. However, a hasty decision had to be made because there were 300 or 400 coming home from France. Now, our government was very good with its discharged soldiers because if they'd been gassed, it seemed to make it easier for them to get the TB. Of course, some of those who were brought under the label of TB might have had other conditions, chronic bronchitis and a few other things like that crept through. Now, Captain Russell had about 300 or 400 coming home from France in April of 1915, and Ella, his sister, had sold it to the South Australian government the year before for £7,000, and by now it was only 375 acres. And he said that would be good because we want it for the chaps who've got a chance to recover. So that means they can work light duty on the farm. Already he had this idea about rehabilitation, which was strong in his mind from Mama, who was actually a woman called Charlotte Bird, and from his sisters who also had learnt about first aid, which was a very new concept at the time. So a hasty decision was made, and these buildings called chalets were put up round about where the women's playing fields are now from South Road. They were built by the army of wood and iron, and the idea was fresh air, which was considered part of the treatment. Read boiling hot or freezing cold, I'm afraid. In the 1950s, now this sanitarium was still going until 1961. In the 1950s, they put galvanised iron pipes along. These pipes had cold water in them and tried to give the chaps a bit more comfort.
Of course, there was no air conditioning in those days, was there? Was it? Let alone hot and cold running water.
They did have hot and cold water in some of the showers, to my amazement, and soon after that, some electric light and so on too. The thing was, the stone mansion, I call it that, it was a lovely old stone building, was only to be used for nursing administration and doctor's stores and so on. The patients were to live in the chalets, which were these open-sided buildings, a bit of a veranda around, canvas awnings. So that was the treatment of the day.
Were families permitted to visit the patients at the sanatorium?
Yes, that was one of the reasons why the 2 mile distance to the railway station was a negative consideration. They wanted somewhere where people could visit. This was very important. But when they did visit, they weren't allowed to go anywhere near their relative, the fear of infection.
So I gather that TB is an infectious disease.
I think it was assumed that the slightest contact might cause infection, but as we now know, it's usually rather more prolonged. Although one of my nursing friends who only nursed a patient for one afternoon was asked to check out afterwards and to check whether she'd actually caught it. So there's still some idea that it's pretty infectious, yes. It's always been there. In 1837, Mrs. Gouger got off the boat and died, and her baby soon after. William Light had pulmonary TB and managed to do 2 years of survey work first. I've told you mostly about the early days. Bedford Park was a military hospital along with these other 12, but in 1921, repatriation department was commenced and it all changed to repat. And one of the strange repat benefits was canvas. There was lots of it for tents and blind awnings, and there was far too much, and it was still being sold over at our Door Road repat until a few years ago. They didn't know what else to do with it. One of the things about the early days, the State Library has some of the earliest photographs. We have some very rare ones, but they're from the 1940s. But those at the State Library are on the open domain, which means they can be used. And one of them is called Three Nurses at Bedford Park. Now, in actual fact, one of those women is a nursing sister, probably trained in England or at the Royal Adelaide. And the other two have red crosses on them, and they were voluntary aid detachment women. Now, these were usually very well-to-do women who had to provide their own uniforms. They were never paid. They did all the work everywhere in all these hospitals. And they meant that this incredible task of rehabilitating all these people, these multitudes of young men mostly from the Great War, was possible. And Red Cross, apart from training them, also provided huge amounts of the diversional facilities, but also work skills. Our Dr. Russell said all they need is not to be idle and to find some work that's suitable for them. Now, if they went back to Islington Rail Yards, for example, having encapsulated their TB, they'd get back and they'd work hard and the disease would reoccur. So you need light duties. Has anybody wondered why Bedford Industries is called Bedford Industries? It's named for Bedford Park TB Sanitarium. In the 1920s, there was a young woman called Ella Cleggett. She came from Mount Barker and she was a school teacher, but she'd had some hearing loss because of some illness that she had. Wasn't too bad, but it meant she couldn't do ordinary classroom teaching. She was, as is typical of the time, it's different now, of course, but everyone was so patriotic. And she used to go down to Bedford Park and sit with the young men, and she saw the stigma that was attached to TB, and she also saw what would happen if a person did recover, they'd lose part of their pension. She began to work very hard to try and improve the situation. She put out these wonderful pamphlets. And I'm wearing a little badge which is called TB Soldiers Aid Society. We still have it. It's here in the city. There's an office. And it was their task to try and improve the situation for the boys who were getting better, or those which the repatriation department decided their TB was not due to war service. And that sometimes happened. There was a very controversial organisation in those days because quite often Ella and her fellow volunteers would send the patient off to another doctor to get another opinion if the repat opinion hadn't agreed. And, you know, there was a lot of controversy between different groups. However, Ella finally started a sanitarium up in the northern Flinders Ranges called Angarichina.
I've been there.
I have never been there.
You need to go.
I'd love to go there. Some of my friends have been, and apparently the historical records are quite good. The first lot of chaps she had up there were those whose TB was considered not to be due to war service, and she continued in that vein, essentially. One of the chaps she had up there had had TB, but he had been the manager of a furniture factory, and she grabbed him, put him in her Packard car, as she used to do, and enthused them, take them up there, and he became an instructor. Now, up at Angarichina, I don't know if you went there, you might have discovered that after the building of the Alice Springs Railway, there were a lot of red gum sleepers down by the creek, and they were well seasoned, and the bar smiths, who were great benefactors in Adelaide, provided woodworking tools for these men. And they made the most beautiful furniture, and it became convalescent art. The governor's lady had provided them with some Queen Anne furniture to copy, but red gum's so hard to work.
Oh, you're telling me. It's like carving iron, isn't it?
Apparently. And these guys, of course, had depleted lungs as well. However, they made modified Queen Anne furniture. Port Lincoln had it for their council chambers, and I have been trying to track it down, and I've not been able to find. South Australian Art Gallery has several samples of it, but they're not the really beautiful ones. The best ones were made in the first few years, the late 1920s. They'd bring it down and sell it in Adelaide. The chaps would get a little bit of the money from it and so on. But 20 years after that, the civilians decided the military had had it too good. Dr. Cohen, here in Adelaide, he wanted an industrial colony for the civilians who by now could go to Bedford Park TB Hospital from 1927 anyway. And he wanted to start an industrial colony on the slopes where now Flinders University is. But he discovered that there was one had been set up in the eastern states that wasn't doing too well. The stigma meant that an industrial colony meant that the chaps with TB could have their wives and their children and houses, and they discovered that nobody wanted to know the children, nobody wanted to know the wives. They were ostracised, and the idea would not take off. But Albert Pimlott, who'd been teaching this beautiful furniture making up at Angarichina, had come back down to Adelaide, and he said, well, let's get started. So he got a shed in Glenelg and started with about 12 guys, TB patients, and it never looked back. And they called it Bedford for Bedford Park and Industries because of Dr. Cohen, Darcy Cohen's idea about an industrial colony. To some extent, that is why it's called Bedford Industries and became the great organisation that it has become. I believe it has a new name and I can't remember what the name is now.
I can't either, but I do know of the work of Bedford Industries, yes, and their continuing work, particularly with disabled. It's fabulous.
Of course, at first it was just TB patients, and then later on they diversified, and under new management it grew, and it was people with different abilities now, not disabilities, who were being treated. So that's it. I've told you the story about Ella Cleggett, Angarichina, and a chap called Albert Pimlott, who helped make beautiful furniture.
Before we go on, Wendy, I'm really amazed at Ella Cleggett's story. What became of her? She was so much ahead of her time. She was an advocate before advocates were really well known.
I have got the family history book and she's not mentioned in it. The family need to know what a wonderful woman she was. Her grave has got a little... It's over at Mitcham Cemetery and it's got a little memento, but essentially Ella Cleggett is not well known. I've got a life-size hero statue of her at home in my living room, which the lovely historian who taught me about local history, we wanted to put them up in the streets. But unfortunately, Maggie died that year and they never got put up in the streets. Ella's there beautifully with a picture of Angarichina and her 1920 clothes, and she looks quite gorgeous. She's a real hero to me. As you say, a woman who was ahead of her time, very controversial. She would cross high mountains. What I want to tell you now is none of this would have come to light, really, if it hadn't been for a porter at Flinders Medical Centre whose name was Paul Kane. Some people who might have read the hospital journals and so on would know that he'd written some very good articles. Now, Paul Kane was working down there in the 1990s, and his uncle had been a chaplain who visited the sanitarium previously. And Paul said, look, there's an old hospital that's been here. And he said, yes, I know it. And he said, there's a public service magazine for 1949 that'll tell you all about it, but I happen to know the bloke who wrote it. So Paul went to see his father's friend, the chap who wrote this public service notice, whose name eludes me at the moment. Here it is, Kevin Hines, 1946, Public Service Review. And Kevin had a dozen old photographs, tiny negatives. And my friend the porter had them enlarged, and we now have some very rare old photographs of the hospital ward, the long paths. It looks just like our repat was until last year. Beautifully manicured gardens, the old stone building still there, although it had been damaged in the 1902 earthquake and again in 1954. But you can see it. And those photographs are kept at Mitcham Heritage Research Centre, which is in Princes Street, Mitcham. They were donated by Paul Kane. So at last I could see what the place was like. And then I discovered that Flinders University has some aerial archival photos, about 120. anyone who's interested in the history of Marion and tomato houses and the development of the suburbs all around there will get wonderful views by looking at Flinders University archival photos. And they will show Flinders University being built, 1960s, and the old sanitarium just before it was demolished in about 1964-65. It will show the beginning of Bedford Park as a suburb and a whole row of streets that were demolished even while some of the houses were still being built to make way for Flinders Drive. It will show the old University Drive, you know, where Sturt College is, and University Hall. It shows University Drive running right through the sanitarium. That would give people an idea that some of it was on the hillside and some of it was down closer to where the hospital is built. Now, if you were to stand at the courtyard at Flinders Medical Centre and look towards the city, you would virtually be where the big old stone house was. Of course, Don Dunstan came along and ploughed the first sod in 1972, and TB Sanitarium disappeared into a hole in the ground, and Flinders Medical Centre, a very innovative and different sort of hospital, grew in its place, and there are photos, many, many photos showing those details, and also of the university when it was being built. If you have time, I would love to tell you the story of one soldier.
Please do, because that was going to be my next question. Were there any standouts amongst those patients or those workers from those days?
It's been extremely hard for me to get hold of the names of the first patients. We did have the first name. There is a wonderful book called The Repat by Dr. Peter Last, and he mentions the first person, a chap called someone Baxter. But I have recently been able to get hold of about 12 names. They had come over from what is now Scotch College, which was one of our military hospitals at the time. They were some of the severe ones and they died. There is a chance to get those names, but because they are in folders with there's a 100-year limit, and we've reached the 100 years. 1917 was when the sanitarium was built, and so by June 2017, we can start to get them, but they're in the same folders as later ones, so you can't get hold of them too much. But one of the important people that people would remember from last year was Private Miller Mack. Private Miller Mack was a Narrangeri man who went off to the war, did his service, got sick straight away, virtually, on the ship going over and died soon after. He was admitted to Bedford Park. He was a man among men while he was a soldier. He was a man among men while he was a patient. They got together and collected money for his grave. He was buried in West Terrace Cemetery, but I think last year his remains were to be returned to Raukan, to his home.
With a fitting ceremony.
Yes, a dawn ceremony, I think. The story I'm going to tell you is of a chap called Alfred Clark. Alfred has his family's permission for me to tell his story. He was a regular soldier. He'd been at the Boer War and he came home and he actually enlisted for the Great War when he was 36, got promoted to sergeant, was in France, got gassed, came home, got married, had four children and took a soldier settler block down at Kalangadu near where his family had lived. Gradually got sick. Now, the soldier settler blocks down there didn't do well anyway, and Alfred started the first RSL down at Kalangadu. I wouldn't know anything about him except that one day when we were talking about the closing of the Repat, I was at the dentist and another man and I got talking and it turned out to be his grandson. He let me explore Alf's history because they wanted to know if he'd ever gone to Angarichina. They believed he had. It's a moot point. We don't think he got there. Anyway, Alfred got sick and they brought his wife and children in from the soldier settler block into Kalangadu and they brought him to Adelaide and he was admitted to Bedford Park. He saw the pamphlets that Ella Cleggett had distributed around because Ella started her TB association from Bedford Park. He saw the pamphlets and he saw this wonderful place called Angarichina and he wanted to go there. He'd also been advised, please can he get his wife and kiddies up from Kalangadu to come to the city. I think he had £34 in the bank and they were paying 12 and 6 a week for accommodation down there. They didn't own property. Ella helped. Somehow, I think it was a precedent, they had his soldier settler block exchanged for a new house in Edwardstown. Now, the family still owned that house a few years ago. I think they still do. They had sold it, but they bought it back again. Anyway, that was one way that Ella was able to help the family. She also was able to help them greatly when Alf was a sick man in Bedford Park. Oh, I forgot to tell you. When they'd built the lovely house at Edwardstown, Alf could come home for the weekends. You weren't always stuck in your sanitarium. And they borrowed a sleep out from a benefactor in a nearby suburb and put it on the back of the house. And that was supposed to keep Alf isolated. Now, he had had four children, but after a while there were five.
So not so isolated.
Not quite isolation. And they called it Alfred's last gasp. And she's a lovely lady and I've met her. So Alf must have got a bit better because he went up to Broken Hill to see his brother and he got very, very sick. They had to bring him home. And after that, he went to Myrtle Bank. Now, Myrtle Bank's another of these military hospitals, it was, and it was for the sick ones. It was almost a hospice. It was where you died. Often they didn't send them across because you don't want to leave your friends just because you're dying. But in his case, yes, because he was later and it was almost time for Myrtle Bank to close. He died in 1931 anyway. Now, the amazing thing was the children, with their mother had become very sick and she was in Northfield Hospital with a skin condition, a terrible condition, and she couldn't look after her five children. So Legacy took them on and they went to an orphanage. And their son, Ted, whom I've met and who has agreed for us to talk about this story, said he had a very happy childhood. All the children were kept together and he has raised $250,000 in bottle collections for Legacy. He's now a man in his early 90s, but he's done all this as a thank you.
Amazing, yeah. Just and amazing. And yeah, that's just one family that were assisted by Legacy and continue to be assisted by Legacy.
Somerville Reading Room have all the records of the communication and the letters between Alfred's wife and Ella Cleggett. You have to have special permission. I had permission because I was helping the family to find out. No, he didn't get to Angerich. No, he was too sick. And Ella wrote back and said, I'm sorry, I've got to give his place to someone else. The family continued to say, yes, their family story is that he did get there. We don't know. The records of Angerich were burnt down or stolen or something. And apart from the ones in the Somerville Reading Room, which tell the story that I've just told you now, we don't think he made it. But it was a happy family memory that he had. And they'd all been up there to have a look at it and they'd wished that he had been there. It was such a wonderful place to be. And I'm just every year when it comes around to Anzac Day and I hear how everybody talks about Gallipoli, which is, of course, it's commemorating, but I wish that the story of the chaps who came home would be told. And that's why I'm glad to be on air talking about this story now, because it is an amazing story of the change in how we began to rehabilitate people. From talking about tuberculosis and cripples and mentals and syphilitics, we talk about people now and we talk about abilities, not disabilities. And this is part of our story and how it came about.
Wendy, what happened with Lieutenant Colonel Russell? How did his career progress?
He and his brother Ernest also had GP work in Unley. They both got the OBE for their continual work with Red Cross and St John. Back in the Boer War, there was only one ambulance and it was left in South Africa. That's how far we've come. And an ambulance was something you walked to ambulate. It wasn't a motorised vehicle like we know now.
You mentioned also that the nurses weren't entitled to attend the Bedford Park Sanatorium.
No.
And yet they had been at war. They yes. had been in battle zones. They had nursed these men on those fields. Mm. What happened with them? Were they allocated a separate hospital? What happened?
I think some of them had to go to the Cancer and Consumptive Hospital or the Royal Adelaide. One lucky nursing sister got a veranda bed at Keswick. We only know because there were some photos taken and she's being visited. But there was another one who was nursed in a tent on the parade ground at Keswick by a devoted fellow nurse who looked after her. I think she only got 12 and sixpence a week or something. Their pension was so much lower than the men. Even though they were entitled to it, there wasn't enough money. And so she was looked after in a tent on the grounds. Things weren't too crash hot for the girls.
Wendy, you've given several talks about this very subject. How have they been received and do you advertise your talks?
When I know that I'm giving one, I was determined to have one in 1917 because it was a centenary, and I was determined I would do it on site. So luckily, Flinders Private Hospital helped. We had an open day in the foyer. My experience was that people did not want to stop and look at anything which was on a table in a hospital foyer. I'm sure they thought I was trying to sell something. They would walk past with their eyes averted. That was not a success. However, the Messenger Press put an article out, and that gave us 35 people who came to visit, together with some staff from the hospital, and they turned on a lovely afternoon tea. They're always very enthusiastically received. I've had several ex-patients who've joined us and were able to fill us in on what was happening in the 1950s when they used to go fishing and sit on logs in the yard and yarn. But it still remains very unknown. The new Flinders Hospital section, which we've all seen being built, has wards named after the First World War streets, Messines and other streets like that, and picture of Door House, and there are some rehabilitation people who attend that hospital. I'd be very keen for them to know that they are actually on repatriation ground, which it was from 1921 to 1927. I don't think they know that. I wish they did.
We didn't talk about the outcome of treatment for tuberculosis, did we?
Well, of course, the sanitarium closed in 1961 because the numbers were dropping. TB has not disappeared. We haven't overcome it completely, but with streptomycin and with the treatments that came in, we no longer had requirement for a sanitarium, or that kind of treatment was gone. And the building became a remand home for a few years, from 1961 to 65. Now, I really can't tell you the treatment for tuberculosis now, except there's a range of antibiotics. Compliance is still a factor. If people don't complete the course, then the disease is not necessarily eradicated. We had a friend of ours who had TB of the larynx. We didn't know. He'd got it during the war, Second World War, and he suddenly said, "Oh, my throat, it's really strange. You know, I can't swallow, I can't." And it was TB. It's still there.
You mentioned the Tubercular Soldiers Aid Society still exists here in Adelaide.
Yes.
What do they do?
I think they are assisting with those families who have got TB. They also keep the old records, and there are some beautifully carved red gum urns from back in the old day of the convalescent art that was produced at Angarichina. And they will give you permission if you want to research further. You need to contact them. TBSAS, Tubercular Soldiers Association, 261 to 265 Morford Street, Adelaide. And you need their help for contact for access to their records at the State Library Somerville Reading Room, for example, about Angarichina, and correspondence between families and themselves.
What a fabulous insight into South Australia's history, not only South Australia, but the whole of Australia, because in other states they would have been going through the same sort of issues, wouldn't they?
I don't know if we were unique. The Commonwealth Government provided the funding and the diagnosis and so on, and we provided the buildings and the
treatment.
It worked quite well.
So you're saying they weren't purely South Australian soldiers that were being treated there?
No, actually, one I know about came from Melbourne because the facilities were also in other states.
Wendy, thank you very much.
Thank you.